ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, a retrial ordered in the high-profile Victorian murder case of former pilot Greg Lynn. Also, why has the United States seized a Venezuelan oil tanker? And more calls for the overhaul of the justice system as the nation records the highest number of Aboriginal deaths in custody since 1979.
We are locking up people who are seriously mentally unwell. We should be funding the services to support those people.
First this evening, a retrial has been ordered in one of Victoria's most high-profile murder cases. Former commercial pilot Greg Lynn today won an appeal against his conviction for the murder of high country camper Carol Clay in 2020. A jury had found Mr. Lynn guilty last year. But today, the Victorian Court of Appeal ruled there are a number of serious problems in the conduct of his trial. Kimberly Price reports.
The trial of Greg Lynn, who was found guilty last year of murdering Carol Clay in the Victorian High Country, has captivated the public. And today's decision to set aside his conviction is another twist. Detective Sergeant Brett Florence was a key investigator in the case, and speaking outside court afterwards had little to say.
Can everyone just sort of leave the families alone? They're quite devastated, so thank you.
Also saying very little was Greg Lynn's barrister, Dermot Dan KC.
No, the Court of Appeal had ordered a retrial, so it would be not appropriate to make public comment.
The story began in 2020 with the alleged murder of elderly couple Carol Clay and Russell Hill in Bucks Camp, 30 kilometres from Mount Buller in northeast Victoria.
Police are still puzzled by the mystery disappearance of two missing campers in Victoria's High Country.
What happened to camping companions Carol Clay and Russell Hill?
For 20 months, what happened to the couple was a mystery.
A breakthrough in the investigation came when police arrested commercial pilot Greg Lynn and charged him with murder. It was alleged a fight took place at the campsite after an argument about a drone. After Mr. Lynn was found guilty of murdering Carol Clay, he was sentenced to 32 years in prison, but was acquitted of the charge relating to Russell Hill. Greg Lynn has always maintained his innocence and lodged an appeal. Today, that appeal was successful. But although the Victorian Court of Appeal has set aside the murder conviction, it has also ordered a retrial. Dr. Brianna Chessa is an associate professor in criminology and justice at RMIT University, a forensic psychologist and criminal lawyer. She says the four grounds of Mr. Lynn's appeal were as follows.
The prosecution had attacked the credibility of the accused person in this instance, Mr. Lynn, without putting any of that argument to the applicant first. Ground two was that they did the same thing with the evidence of one of the expert witnesses. Ground three, because the prosecution decided to conduct their matter in that particular way, that the jury then travelled down what the Court of Appeal Justices have called an impermissible pathway, arriving at the guilty verdict. And then the last ground was the guilty verdict was unsafe and unsatisfactory.
Dr. Chessa says the Court of Appeal Justices accepted Mr. Lynn's appeal on grounds one and two. Mr. Lynn will now have to stand trial again at a later date, just on the charge of murdering Carol Clay.
You might remember that regarding the death of Mr. Hill, that Mr. Lynn was acquitted of that particular charge, and the rules against double jeopardy mean that he cannot be tried for the same crime twice.
Dr. Chessa says during the process, the Court of Appeal had the option to acquit Greg Lynn completely.
The justices actually commented on this directly, and what they said was it's in the interest of justice to require a new trial because there's such a powerful public interest in making sure that there's a fair trial and because the charge of murder is the most serious criminal offence that we have.
Mr. Lynn will be remanded in custody until the end of January, after which his defence team can apply for bail. Between now and the retrial starting in late 2026 or 2027, Dr. Chessa says both the prosecution and the defence will need to reform their arguments.
The last trial was about two different circumstances, the death of Russell Hill and of Carol Clay. In this instance, we're only looking at the death of Carol Clay, and that really is going to mean that both the prosecution and potentially the defence in responding to the prosecution are going to need to reassess. The prosecution obviously has to tighten up their case. They may also reconsider what the charge is. It may well drop down to manslaughter.
As there has been significant public interest in this case, Dr. Chesser believes a judge-only trial could be an option, as it may be difficult to find an impartial jury.
My instinct is that they will seek to impanel another jury. I think the defence has a lot to be gained by having the reasonable person, the jury member, the member of the community in the room, and having them be the one that adjudicates the facts.
The next court mentioned for Mr. Lin's trial is listed for January 28.
Kimberly Price reporting. Tension between the United States and Venezuela is escalating after the US seized a large oil tanker off the coast of the South American country. The US President Donald Trump is yet to properly explain why the tanker was seized, but it comes as the US continues to apply pressure to the regime of the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Venezuela's government has condemned the capture of the tanker as barefaced robbery and an act of international piracy. Over the last couple of months, the US has launched more than 20 strikes against boats in the region, killing more than 80 people. It alleged those aboard were smuggling drugs. Timothy Lynch is a professor of American politics at the University of Melbourne and specialises in American foreign policy. I asked him for his thoughts on why the US has ordered the seizing of this Venezuelan tanker.
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is the immediate, sometimes inchoate and inconsistent approach Trump has had to Maduro, the dictator of Venezuela, and the seizure of the tanker is very much of a piece with this strategy of destabilizing him, exposing his links to drug trafficking and indeed to Iran, where there is all sorts of nefarious shipments of oil back and forth. And you'll remember, of course, last summer, northern summer, Trump attacked Iran. So there's that immediate history and context I think Trump has with Venezuela. But it's also, I think, important to recognize the much longer background to all this. And that's US agitation in frequent interventions in its own hemisphere across the last 200 years. And Venezuela now is hardly unlikely to escape what Trump is seeing, as far as he understands historical doctrine, as a reassertion of America's, the United States' right to police and control its own hemisphere. We call this the Monroe Doctrine.
Mr. Trump, as we know, isn't averse to being quite friendly with dictators. Vladimir Putin comes to mind, the leader of Hungary, for example. So tell us more about Maduro and what is it about him and his government that seems to really rankle Mr. Trump?
With Maduro, there's history here, and it's framed by a kind of Cold War hangover here. This is a self-declared Marxist. He's running an anti-American regime. I mean, we think always that America demonizes its opponents and forget that part of Maduro's hold on power, which is increasingly tenuous, but has lasted over the decade since the Hugo Chavez died, part of his appeal to his own people is that he's sticking it to the United States. So they're both feeding off a kind of the anti-version of the other. And it's their backyard, of course, as well. And this is the difference. America does assume a right to act in its own backyard because it's so dominant within it. And there is a body of thought, I think, which says, why should we have to put up with the nefarious practices and the open anti-Americanism of this guy when we have the resources in our backyard to deal with it?
I understand that Venezuela's oil reserves are, if not the biggest in the world, amongst the biggest in the world. So what role does oil play in this tension?
So oil is a component of what drives America in this situation. But again, I'd put to you a similar scenario that we saw in the Middle East. It's much easier to buy oil from Venezuela than it is to foster regime change and then pay some sort of price for what comes next, bear a burden for what comes next.
Do you think President Trump is set on regime change?
No, I'm not sure that Donald Trump knows exactly what he intends here.
How likely is it, do you think, that the conflict will worsen?
In geographic terms, one of the nearest conflicts that we might reflect on is Cuba. And of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis 63 years ago nearly led to a global nuclear war. So there's reason to believe that escalation is entirely possible, that America will take a threat within its own sphere seriously. But that, as Cuba proves, it is capable of negotiation and not going over the brink. He's a deal maker. Why doesn't he just do a deal with the bad guy in the way that he sought to do a deal with other big bad guys in other states like Russia and China? Why the exception with Maduro?
Is Venezuela capable of defending itself?
No, I think Mercado, the opposition leader, may well have more support than we are led to believe. And that would be demonstrated by greater American agitation against even an invasion of Venezuela by US Marines. That could well reveal a much greater appetite for a regime change amongst the Venezuelan people. And Trump may want to, if he thinks about history at all and his place in it, he might be thinking of himself as someone, as a president that created a new Venezuela. If there is going to be a revolution, all the support for an opposition leader is there. It just needs a catalyst. And it could be that Trump's behavior and his threats, his seizure of oil tankers could be that catalyst.
Professor Timothy Lynch from the University of Melbourne. The number of Indigenous Australians dying in custody has risen to its highest level in 45 years. More than 30 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander prisoners died in jails and other detention facilities in the last financial year, according to new figures from the Australian Institute of Criminology. Indigenous advocates say the justice system needs to change the way it treats people with mental illness. Rachel Hayter reports.
33 Aboriginal people died in custody in the last financial year, 10 by suicide.
We are locking up people who are seriously mentally unwell.
Martin Hodgson is an Aboriginal senior legal advocate with the Disappeared Project, which helps families of mainly Aboriginal people missing, murdered or forcibly disappeared. He believes this data from the Australian Institute of Criminology reflects the criminalisation of mental illness.
We wouldn't lock up people who were dying of cancer and needed treatment or any other serious disease. Across the board in every state and territory, Aboriginal people, particularly young people, are being locked up when they're suffering complex mental health conditions. And so not only are they not receiving effective treatment, they're being put in isolation and left for the only result that's going to come when you put such a vulnerable person in such a place.
The 1991 Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody found that Indigenous people are disadvantaged by prejudicial policing, especially for minor crimes relating to public order, which can sometimes be connected with complex mental health issues. More than three decades later, Martin Hodgson believes that's still the case.
What you see, whether it's Aboriginal young people and particularly Aboriginal women, is the criminalisation of their public displays of the symptoms of their complex mental health condition. We should not be policing people because of their illness. We should be funding the services to support those people.
Treat the trauma rather than punish it.
Dr. Tracy Westerman is an Aboriginal psychologist. She's the founder of the Westerman Julia Institute for Indigenous Mental Health and the director of Indigenous Psychological Services. Dr. Westerman explains that both mental illness and contact with the justice system can be intergenerational, which means that if you've got parents who are mentally unwell, you are more likely to experience mental illness yourself. And if your parents have been to jail, you're more likely to spend time there too.
Often what you find is that people who come into contact with the system or kids who come into contact with the system have often had someone in their background who's also been incarcerated. So if we can proactively get in there and identify those potentially future incarcerated young people, then we can prevent them from coming into contact with the system entirely.
Separate data released today by the Australian Bureau of Statistics shows that in the last financial year, the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander prisoners increased by 10% to 17,432, which is 37% of people in custody in Australia. That's despite Indigenous people making up less than 4% of the population. First Nations advocates say it's therefore no surprise that the number of Aboriginal people dying in jail is the highest it's been in more than 45 years. Dr. Westerman is calling for people to be screened for risk of suicide before they're put behind bars.
We see this a lot with successive inquiries that people have risk, suicide risk, mental health risk, and no one is actually assessing them in a culturally informed way when they first come in. Therefore, we're not actually ensuring that those people are safe when they're actually placed in prison.
She also wants corrections authorities to listen more when Aboriginal people in custody say they need help.
A vast majority of Indigenous people, about 40% I think, who have died in custody have actually asked for medical assistance prior to their death, about 40%, and that number is actually increasing. So most of those requests for assistance were ignored.
Dr. Tracy Westerman from the Westerman Gillier Institute for Indigenous Mental Health. That report from Rachel Hayter. And if that story has caused you any distress, you can call the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Crisis Support Line. That's 13YARN on 139276. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. A Melbourne teenager says she felt betrayed and saddened after her image was removed from a local government publication because she wore a Palestinian pendant. After receiving several complaints, Bayside Council in Melbourne's southeast replaced the online and hard copy editions of its local magazine that featured a photo of the student wearing the pendant. The peak body for Palestinian Australians says it's an example of rising anti-Palestinian sentiment. Miwa Bloom reports.
Melbourne student Zaina has spent years as a community volunteer. In May, she received a youth award from Bayside Council for her efforts.
I've done photography, MC, and then I also am a youth ambassador. We've planned and run activities with kids at a local housing estate.
In September, Zaina, whose grandparents were born in Palestine, was interviewed by Bayside Council about using the local libraries. Her photograph was featured on the cover of the monthly magazine, with an article printed inside. Copies of the magazine were distributed to a couple of suburbs, but then the edition was pulled.
We only found out after they made the decision, so at that point they already had pulled it down and stopped sending it out.
In a statement, Bayside Council said it withdrew the October-November edition of the magazine because it featured a political symbol, which contravenes the council's media policy. The council said it received several complaints about Zaina's jewellery. In the photograph published, Zaina was wearing a pendant in the shape of historical Palestine, which is modern-day Israel, as well as the occupied Palestinian territories, which include Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. It features a Palestinian flag with Palestine written in Arabic. Zaina's grandparents fled to Lebanon during what's known as the Nakba, the mass displacement and dispossession of Palestinians during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War and the establishment of Israel. Zaina says she wears the pendant to represent her cultural heritage and was disappointed when the council decided to recall her photograph.
Made me feel very, sad and, disappointed and betrayed. They turned it into something very, divisive and very negative.
Bayside Council says it has ongoing contact with Zaina. During a council meeting in October, Bayside CEO Matthew Cripps issued a statement to say he unreservedly apologised for the distress caused by the photographs, adding that the council had no intention of promoting personal or political interests. But Zaina and her mother say they have not been offered an apology for how the publication and the subsequent removal of the image was handled. Nasser Mashni is the president of the Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network.
In Australia, just merely expressing your culture, your identity, your heritage is enough to get you cancelled.
The network has recently launched an anti-Palestinian racism register to monitor discrimination.
Anecdotal phone calls I've been getting, direct messages, WhatsApp notes, people coming up to me in the street and just telling me what they've been experiencing is, you know, it's a rampant, unchecked, uncounted form of racism.
The map of historical Palestine divides opinion. Alex Rivchen heads up the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. He supports the council's decision to remove the photo in the magazine and says the map is offensive to Jews.
When you have someone displaying Greater Palestine, that is an overtly nationalistic symbol. And it's a nationalistic symbol that also displaces and denies the legitimacy of a Jewish homeland in that land, which has been there for thousands of years. So I can completely understand why people would be upset by it.
He said he'd make the same criticism of a map of Greater Israel that discounted the existence of Palestinian legitimacy. Dr. Max Kaiser is the executive officer of the Jewish Council of Australia. He says Bayside Council was wrong to remove the photo of Zaina.
The map of historical Palestine is where Palestinian people come from, whether they are people who are living there currently, whether they're people who have been made refugees. Having a map of historic Palestine or Palestine as a whole is not offensive.
He believes Zaina should receive an apology from the council.
And I think that the council should be apologising to this young woman for the upset that they've caused her. Yeah, frankly, very disappointing anti-Palestinian racism.
Dr. Max Kaiser from the Jewish Council of Australia. That report from Miwa Bloomer and Bridget Fitzgerald. Today marks 20 years since the Cronulla riots broke out in Sydney. The chaos was triggered by the alleged attack of two off-duty surf lifesavers by young men of Middle Eastern appearance. It prompted about 5,000 young men from Anglo-Australian backgrounds to gather in Cronulla. By the evening, the atmosphere had shifted from barbecues and the flying of flags to violence. Nicole Johnston filed this report.
They say they're Australian, they've been carrying the flag and they've been singing the national anthem. It started out as a carnival atmosphere though, has turned ugly.
On December 11, 2005, thousands of Anglo-Australians gathered in Cronulla after mass text messages urged them to go and reclaim the beach. It came in response to the alleged assault on off-duty surf lifesavers a week earlier by men of Middle Eastern appearance. By late afternoon, alcohol had kicked in and the rally turned violent. A group of young, white men attacked people they perceived to be from Middle East backgrounds.
I remember the Cronulla riots very, very well. We were heavily involved in that scene.
Imam Sheikh Shadi Al Sulaiman was in Sydney when the riots broke out.
It just sparked between the communities and within the Muslim community and the Arab community, text messages were going around. And obviously, we're talking about youngsters. Usually youngsters are very excited and motivated and unfortunately lack maturity. And and not only within the Muslim community and the Arab community, obviously from the other community, from the Anglo-Saxon community. And those that were in Cronulla, where unfortunately youngsters wanted to flex their muscles at that time and showcase who's the strongest and who's the most powerful, which is wrong from all sides. And it was the worst thing that we've ever seen. Unfortunately, it is a dark history in the Australian history that we hope and pray that it never repeats itself ever again.
Imam Shadi is the president of the Australian National Imams Council.
I remember those nights very, very clearly because there was a huge congregation at Lekemba Mosque. People were just angry, screaming. We were trying to calm everyone down, de-escalate the situation.
How much of a shock was this for Australia's Middle Eastern community to have this type of violence and rhetoric and racism brought out into the open like this?
It was a big shock because we're not talking about a strange place. We're talking about a place that we know very, very well. And for this to come out and emerge, it was an absolute shock to the community, nor that we expected something like this to ever happen.
Carl Scully was the New South Wales Minister for Police at the time all of this happened. He was later sacked, accused of misleading Parliament over how he handled a report into the riots.
After that day, that evening, the revenge attacks commenced and they were off the charts compared to what happened during the day. Maroubra was smashed up, people were subjected to baseball attacks, knife attacks, and that's where we had to bring in hundreds and hundreds of more police to deal with this. But there's not much film evidence of that.
So how long did these revenge attacks go on for and what eventually calmed it down?
Well, it's interesting. I strongly believe that the police powers we gave, which allowed police to confiscate phones, confiscate cars, to close down liquor outlets, and to shut down whole suburbs, finally got the message through.
For all the trauma, Sheikh Shadi says the crisis brought his community together.
There has been a long history of many Muslims who feel they are ostracised and isolated, and the Cronulla riots did shake that thought in the Muslim community, where we need to start focusing a lot on the next generation and making sure they have that sense of belonging, not only that are Muslims, but they're also Australians, and they contribute positively to the country that they live in.
Sheikh Shadi Al-Sulaiman is the president of the Australian National Imams Council. Nicole Johnston reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. PM will be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hello, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. Minister Annika Wells is under intense pressure to justify her use of government entitlements, even if it's all within the rules. Today, Chief Political Correspondent at The Conversation, Michelle Grattan, on whether politicians deserve the benefits and why it's both a honeypot and a trap. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.